This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom by David W. Blight. Read by Prentiss Onayemi.
To Walter O. Evans and Linda J. Evans, and to Jeffrey Brown Ferguson, 1964 to 2018. There is a prophet within us, forever whispering that behind the seen lies the immeasurable unseen. Frederick Douglass, 1862. Introduction. Behold, I have put my words in your mouth, to pluck up and to break down, to destroy and to overthrow, to build and to plant. Jeremiah, chapter 1, verses 9 and 10. In his speech at the dedication of the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C., September 24, 2016, President Barack Obama delivered what he termed a clear-eyed view of a tragic and triumphant history of Black Americans in the United States. He spoke of a history that is central to the larger American story, one that is both contradictory and extraordinary. He likened the African American experience to the infinite depths of Shakespeare and Scripture. "The embrace of truth, as best we can know it," said the president, "is where real patriotism lies." Naming some of the major pivots of the country's past, Obama wrapped his central theme in a remarkable sentence about the Civil War era. "We've buttoned up our Union blues to join the fight for our freedom. We've railed against injustice for decade upon decade, a lifetime of struggle and progress and enlightenment that we see etched in Frederick Douglass's mighty leonine gaze." How Americans react to Douglass's gaze, indeed, how we gaze back at his visage, and more important, how we read him, appropriate him, or engage his legacies, informs how we use our past to determine who we are. Douglass's life and writings emerge from nearly the full scope of the 19th century, representative of the best and the worst in the American spirit. Douglass constantly probed the ironies of America's contradictions over slavery and race. Few Americans used Shakespeare and the Bible to comprehend his story and that of his people as much as Douglass. And there may be no better example of an American radical patriot than the slave who became a lyrical prophet of freedom, natural rights, and human equality. Obama channeled Douglass in his dedication speech. Knowingly or not, so do many people today. Born Frederick Augustus Washington Bailey, a slave in Talbot County, Maryland, in February 1818, the future Frederick Douglass was the son of Harriet Bailey, one of five daughters of Betsy Bailey, and with some likelihood, his mother's white owner. He saw his mother for the last time in 1825, though he hardly knew her. She died the following year. Douglass lived 20 years as a slave and nearly 9 years as a fugitive slave subject to recapture. From the 1840s to his death in 1895, he attained international fame as an abolitionist, editor, orator of almost unparalleled stature, and the author of three autobiographies that are classics of the genre. As a public man, he began his abolitionist career 2 decades before America would divide and fight a civil war over slavery that he openly welcomed. Douglass was born in a backwater of the slave society of the South, just as steamboats appeared in bays and on American rivers, and before the telegraph, the railroad, and the rotary press changed human mobility and consciousness. He died after the emergence of electric lights, the telephone, and the invention of the phonograph. The renowned orator and traveler loved and used most of these elements of modernity and technology. Douglass was the most photographed American of the 19th century, explained in this book and especially by the intrepid research of three other scholars I rely upon. Although it can never really be measured, he may also have been, along with Mark Twain, the most widely traveled American public figure of his century. By the 1890s, in sheer miles and countless numbers of speeches, he had few rivals as a lecturer in the golden age of oratory. It is likely that more Americans heard Douglass speak than any other public figure of his times. Indeed, to see or hear Douglass became a kind of wonder of the American world. He struggled as well with the pleasures and perils of fame as much as anyone else in his century, with the possible exceptions of General Ulysses S. Grant or P.T. Barnum. Douglass's dilemma with fame was a matter of decades, not merely of moments, and fraught with racism. The orator and writer lived to see and interpret black emancipation, to work actively for women's rights long before they were achieved, to realize the civil rights triumphs and tragedies of Reconstruction, and to witness and contribute to America's economic and international expansion in the Gilded Age. He lived to the age of lynching and Jim Crow laws, when America collapsed into retreat from the very victories and revolutions in race relations he had helped to win. He played a pivotal role in America's second founding out of the apocalypse of the Civil War. And he very much wished to see himself as a founder and a defender of the Second American Republic. In one lifetime of anti-slavery, literary, and political activism, Douglass was many things, and this set of apparent paradoxes make his story so attractive to biographers, as well as to so many constituencies today. He was a radical thinker and a proponent of classic 19th century political liberalism. At different times, he hated and loved his country. He was a ferocious critic of the United States and all of its hypocrisies, but also, after emancipation, became a government bureaucrat, a diplomat, and a voice for territorial expansion. He strongly believed in self-reliance and demanded an activist, interventionist government at all levels to free slaves, defeat the Confederacy, and protect black citizens against terror and discrimination. Douglass was a serious constitutional thinker, and few Americans have ever analyzed race with more poignancy and nuance than this mostly self-taught genius with words. He was a radical editor, writer, and activist, informed by a hard-earned pragmatism. Douglass was Jim Crowed more times than he could count, but loved the Declaration of Independence, the natural rights tradition, and especially the reinvented U.S. Constitution fashioned in Reconstruction. He fought against mob violence, but believed in certain kinds of revolutionary violence. In his own career, he heroically tried to forge a livelihood with his voice and pen, but fundamentally was not a self-made man, an image and symbol he touted in a famous speech, and through which modern conservatives have adopted him as a proponent of individualism. He truly believed women were equal and ought to have all fundamental rights, but he conducted his personal life sometimes as a patriarch in a difficult marriage and while overseeing a large, often dysfunctional, extended family. Context and timing are often all. As James Baldwin wrote in 1948, casting sentiment and celebration aside, Frederick Douglass was first of all a man, honest within the limitations of his character and his time, quite frequently misguided, sometimes pompous, gifted, but not always a hero, and no saint at all. Baldwin's unabashed bluntness is a good place for a biographer to begin to make judgments from the sources. But so are the interpretations of a very different writer, the former neoconservative turned neoliberal journalist and political theorist, Michael Lind. In 1995, Lind rejected both a leftist multiculturalism and a conservative self-help individualism and called for a new nationalism, which he termed a multiracial, mixed-race trans-America, with Douglass as the model. Telescoping the orator through time, Lind called Douglass the greatest American of all time. Indeed, the old fugitive slave has become, in the early 21st century, a malleable figure adopted by all elements in the political spectrum, not least by current Republicans, who have claimed Douglass, quite ahistorically, as their own by elevating a single feature of his thought, black self-reliance, at the expense of his enduring radicalism. At the unveiling ceremony of the statue of Douglass in the U.S. Capitol in 2013, chosen by the District of Columbia as one of the two representatives to which each state and the district are entitled, congressional Republicans walked around proudly sporting large buttons that read, "Frederick Douglass was a Republican." Douglass descendants present, as well as some of us scholars with, shall we say, different training and research, smiled and endured. Who's Douglass is a modern question rife with meaning. This book seeks Douglass's complexity in all its forms, but never sidesteps his essential radicalism in a search for heroes we can hold dear and in common. Douglass was and is a hero. He has been all but adopted as a national figure in Ireland, Scotland, and Britain. His narrative is read all over the world. He has appeared in countless murals, satirical political cartoons, 21st century works of fiction, in paintings, and in a great deal of poetry. The sheer complexity of his thought and life makes him an icon held in some degree of commonality. He was brilliant, courageous, and possessed a truly uncommon endurance. He wrote many words that will last forever. His literary genius ranks with that of many of America's greatest writers of his century. But he was also vain, arrogant at times, and hypersensitive to slights. He did not take well to rivals who challenged his position as the greatest spokesman of his race, although he also mentored many younger black writers and leaders. He liked being on a pedestal and did not intend to get knocked off. Douglass was thoroughly and beautifully human. Above all, Douglass is remembered most for telling his personal story, the slave who willed his own freedom, mastered the master's language, saw to the core of the meaning of slavery, both for individuals and for the nation, and then captured the multiple meanings of freedom as idea and reality of mind and body, as perhaps no one else ever has in America. This book exists because of my lifetime interest in Douglass, but I would not have written it had I not encountered the extraordinary private collection of Douglass material owned by Walter O. Evans of Savannah, Georgia. The Evans collection, cited so many times in my notes, makes possible many new insights into the final third of Douglass's life. The younger Douglass, the heroic escaped slave and emerging abolitionist, is better known in part because of the author's first two autobiographies. The older Douglass, from Reconstruction to the end of his life in 1895, has never been so accessible or rendered so fascinating and complicated as in the Evans collection. This biography is, I hope, the fullest account ever written of the last third of Douglass's complex and epic life. Several primary themes inform and give texture to my portrait of Douglass. Douglass was a man of words. Spoken and written language was the only major weapon of protest, persuasion, or power that he ever possessed. Throughout, I try to demonstrate the origins and growth of this man's amazing facility to find the words to explain America's racial condition, as well as the human condition. In one way, this book is the biography of a voice. The autobiographies are themselves a major theme of the book. Douglass wrote and rewrote his life in three remarkable autobiographies. All Douglass scholars are deeply dependent upon them. But the first major problem in writing Douglass's biography is that the subject himself is in the way. The three narratives, over 1,200 pages in all, are infinitely rich as sources of his traumatic youth and his public life of more than 50 years. In the memoirs, he is a self-made hero, who leaves a great deal unsaid, hidden from his readers and his biographers. Douglass invited us into his life over and over, and it is a rich literary and historical feast to read the music of Douglass's words. But as he sits majestically at the head of the table, it is as if he slips out of the room right when we so wish to know more, anything, about his more private thoughts, motivations, and memories of the many conflicts in his personal life. Confronting the autobiographer in Douglass is both a pleasure and a peril as his biographer. Another guiding theme is Douglass's deep grounding in the Bible, especially the Old Testament. From his earliest speeches on the abolition circuit, through his political emergence in the 1850s, in his stunning orations and editorials about the Civil War as an apocalyptic break in history, somehow under God's intervention, to his nearly endless post-war lecture tours, Douglass rooted his own story, and especially the story of African Americans, in the oldest and most powerful stories of the Hebrew prophets. In America, the people had turned from or never embraced their creeds or their God. The American Jerusalem, its temples, and its horrid system of slavery had to be destroyed. The nation had to face exile or extinction and bloody retribution, and only then could the people and the nation experience renewal, reinvention, and a possible new history. Douglass was a living prophet of an American deconstruction, exile, war for its existence, and redemption. Jeremiah and Isaiah, as well as other prophets, were his guides. They gave him story, metaphor, resolve, and ancient wisdom in order to deliver his ferocious critique of slavery and his country before emancipation, and then his strained but hopeful narrative of its future after 1865. It is easy to call Douglass a prophet. This book attempts to show how he merits that lofty title. "The prophet is human," wrote the great Jewish theologian Abraham Heschel, "yet he employs notes one octave too high for our ears. He experiences moments that defy our understanding. He is neither a singing saint nor a moralizing poet, but an assaulter of the mind. Often his words begin to burn where conscience ends." Careful readers of Douglass will at times stop on passages that make them shudder or melt in recognition, as their minds are assaulted or perhaps uplifted. This book attempts to demonstrate how Douglass came by his King James cadences, as well as how he used biblical story to break down and rebuild, as Jeremiah recollected his own charge, an American world. Douglass succeeded and failed, as did the prophets of old. From the middle of his turbulent life on, a primary theme of the book is how Douglass moved along crooked paths from a radical outsider, through time and transcendent events, to a political insider. During the greatest pivot of American history, the Civil War era, this man of language reaped great change to transform from a radical abolitionist into a Republican Party functionary. These changes are historical, inextricably linked to events and time, not merely a matter of moral growth or decline. And they provide a model for many other leaders, particularly African American, who have undergone the same process in the 150 years since. The outsider to insider story especially animates the second half of the book, and it caused one of Douglass's most challenging psychic dilemmas. He repeatedly faced the question of how uncompromising radicalism could mix with a learned pragmatism to try to influence real power, to determine how to condemn the princes and their laws, but also influence and eventually join them. Another theme that drives this book is the turbulent relationship of Douglass's public and private lives. Throughout, I try to keep a balance between these two registers of any person's story. In Douglass's case, he married twice, first to Anna Murray Douglass, a black woman born free in Maryland who remained largely illiterate but the center of his home life through many dislocations for 44 years, and second to Helen Pitts Douglass, a highly educated white woman 20 years his junior and a remarkably compatible companion during his final decade. Douglas sustained important friendships with two white European women, Julia Griffiths from England and Ottilie Ossing from Germany, both of whom became extremely important influences of differing kinds in his life. Most important, though, Douglas and Anna had five children, four of whom lived into adulthood. Among them, they produced 21 grandchildren for the Douglases. During the last quarter or so of the famous man's life, this extended family, which came to include even some fictive kin and a variety of protégés, became financially and often emotionally dependent on the patriarch of a clan often in conflict with itself. Douglas sustained back-breaking and health-threatening lecture tours in his older years, in part to support this extended family, and a big house on a hill in Washington, D.C., near the centers of Gilded Age power that he could only partially penetrate. This story is at once Douglas's own unique saga and very modern. He experienced at least two emotional breakdowns in his life, and both can be explained in great part by the treacherous character of this public-private divide. And finally, this book probes how Douglas was a many-sided intellectual, an editor, a writer in numerous genres, memoir, short-form editorials, extended speeches, and one work of fiction. He wrote and spoke millions of words. His trove of commentary contains beauty, brilliant storytelling, sermons, political stump speeches, and assaults on the mind that are his legacy and the essential reason we know him. In roughly the last 40 years, Douglas has more and more been treated by scholars as a political philosopher, a constitutional and legal analyst, an author capable of prose poetry, a proponent of the natural rights tradition, a self-conscious voice of and about the nature of memory, a religious and theological thinker, a journalist, and an advocate of broader public education. Today, Douglas is taught and examined in law schools, in history, English, art, political science, and philosophy departments, in high schools, graduate schools, and community reading groups. In this book, I try at all times to balance as best I can the narrative of his life with analyses of his evolving mind to give his ideas a central place in his unforgettable story. It is Douglas's story, though, that lasts and gives and instructs. There is no greater voice of America's terrible transformation from slavery to freedom than Douglas's. For all who wish to escape from outward or inward captivity, they would do well to feel the pulses of this life and to read the words of this voice. And then go act in the world. In the final lines of My Bondage and My Freedom in 1855, as the politics of the slavery crisis embroiled the nation, Douglas wrote that he would never forget his own humble origins, nor cease, while heaven lends me ability, to use my voice, my pen, or my vote to advocate the great and primary work of the universal and unconditional emancipation of my entire race. As we look upon Douglas's leonine gaze in our own time, we may recognize that such universal work continues.
Chapter 1. First Things. Genealogical trees do not flourish among slaves. Frederick Douglass, 1855. Throughout the spring morning of April 14th, 1876, a huge crowd, largely African American, began to assemble in the vicinity of 7th and K Streets in Washington, D.C. It had been 11 Aprils since the end of the Civil War, and 11 years to the day since the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. A parade involving nearly every African-American organization in the city was about to step off at noon en route to the unveiling of an extraordinary monument to Lincoln. The city had witnessed many remarkable parades since the end of the war, but this one would be different. The day was declared a public holiday in Washington, and flags above the Capitol, as well as other government buildings, flew at half-mast.
At the head of the procession rode a contingent of 27 mounted police, followed by 3 companies of black militia troops, headed by the Philharmonic Band of Georgetown. Numerous other cornet bands, marching drum corps, youth clubs in colorful uniforms, and fraternal orders from both Washington and Baltimore filled in the long line with pride and pomp. The Knights of St. Augustine carried a large banner with a painting of the martyred Lincoln. Horse-drawn carriages carried, among others, the black Virginia Freeborn professor and dean of the Howard University Law School, John Mercer Langston, who would perform as master of ceremonies and the orator of the day, a newly arrived resident of Washington, the famed abolitionist and editor, Frederick Douglass, who had grown up a slave across Chesapeake Bay on the eastern shore of Maryland. Langston and Douglass were soon to become open political and personal rivals, but on this day, they joined in one of the most important public events of their lives. The procession moved westward along K Street to 17th Street, then south a few blocks and through the grounds of the Executive Mansion, the White House, which in those days was not walled off by security, and on to Pennsylvania Avenue. The parade traveled eastward directly toward the Capitol, turning briefly right on 1st Street West, then around the South Capitol grounds to 1st Street East, and finally on to East Capitol Street. For 11 more blocks, the bands, marchers, and carriages passed throngs of people until they reached 11th Street at the edge of fields and an emerging residential square. The setting was much better than on the Washington Mall, which at that time was swampy and unhealthy, used in places as a dump. A festive crowd awaited the parade, and a tall statue stood draped and concealed in flags and bunting. Next to the monument, a stage and large speaker stand awaited a distinguished array of guests. President Ulysses S. Grant, now nearing the end of his second and final term in office, arrived before the parade reached the park and was accompanied by many U.S. senators, including Oliver P. Morton, George Boutwell, John Sherman, and Blanche K. Bruce, members of the President's cabinet, the justices of the U.S. Supreme Court, many members of the House of Representatives, and a large contingent of other government officials, as well as some former Union generals. Near the platform, the Marine Band struck up Hail Columbia, as the speakers walked from their carriages and the hundreds of marchers found their places in the vast audience. As the ceremony began, Bishop John M. Brown of the AME Church delivered an invocation, and J. Henri Birch of Louisiana read the Emancipation Proclamation. At the conclusion of the reading, the band played La Marseillaise. Langston introduced James E. Yeatman, a St. Louis banker and head of the Western Sanitary Commission, the organization that had led the fundraising among the former slaves and black Civil War veterans of Missouri and elsewhere in the country, who provided the nearly $20,000 that paid for the monument. Yeatman explained how a former slave woman, Charlotte Scott, had donated the first $5, and how the commission had sought the American sculptor Thomas Ball, who resided in Italy, to conceive and create the statue. This remarkable monument, the Freedman's Memorial, as it became known, was many years in the making, the result of various designs and changes in purpose and meaning. In Yeatman's lengthy remarks, he told of Ball's labor of love, his tribute to American patriotism through the gratitude of the freed people. In a triumphal narrative, Yeatman described how Ball sent 4 photographs of his original model of a standing Lincoln and a kneeling slave to the Sanitary Commission, which in turn sent him a photograph of a former fugitive slave named Archer Alexander, whom the sculptor then depicted with muscular torso, looking upward, his fist clenched, and in part breaking his own chains under the president's guiding arm. Since Ball had been convinced by the commission and by the image of Alexander to alter his conception from a kneeling slave represented as perfectly passive, freedom given, to an emancipated slave as agent in his own deliverance, freedom seized, Yeatman concluded that the monument was an ideal group converted into the literal truth of history.
such a ceremonial day in the spring sunshine, surrounded by the highest officials of the federal government, and a monument unveiling unlike any other that had occurred in America, was hardly an occasion for literal truth, whether in bronze or in words. But through all the pageantry would waft some powerful symbolic truths in unforgettable language. Langston stepped to the podium and asked President Grant to come forward to pull the cord and unveil the monument. As Grant stood still for a long moment, the entire crowd hushed in rapt silence. Not a good ceremonial speaker, the president delivered no remarks. As the flags and draperies fell away, the throng broke into loud applause and shouts. Cannon were fired nearby in a field, and the band struck up Hail to the Chief. Those up close could see on the base of the monument the word Emancipation cut in large letters. Langston next read two congratulatory letters from people who had played roles in bringing about the monument. A poem, Lincoln, written by a young black Washington poet, Cordelia Ray, was recited. Then, as parts of the crowd had settled into chairs and others felt the spring breezes over their heads, Langston finally introduced Douglas, orator of the day. Along with Langston and many other black leaders, Douglas had strongly supported various efforts to build a major Lincoln and Emancipation Monument since at least September 1865. That month, he had called for a humble memorial that would express one of the holiest sentiments of the human heart. His remark came in the immediate post-Civil War period, when many white sponsors of such a Lincoln monument openly called on blacks to demonstrate gratitude for their liberation. Douglas had never been one to believe he had to prove his gratitude or dignity or even his acumen to whites generally. He had long understood that a national monument to Lincoln would be a major civic undertaking, as well as a statement about the place of black people in America. From his own visceral experience as a slave and fugitive slave who plotted his own escape, he fully understood just how much freedom for black Americans was both seized and given. Douglas had long favored what he called a people's monument without distinction of color, a tribute that would reflect the story of interracial abolitionism that he believed had helped bring Lincoln to the Emancipation Proclamation, as well as to the new, potentially reimagined nation of 1865, devoted to a future of common rights and common equality before the law. But as Douglas rose to speak in April 1876 to finally dedicate such a monument, he, the recognized voice of Black America, had prepared a speech of remarkable honesty, poignancy, and present-minded historical insight. "First things are always interesting," he declared, "and this is one of our first things. It is the first time that, in this form and manner, we have sought to do honor to an American great man." Douglas made it clear that he spoke, at least at first, only as an African-American for his race. The event was a first for a second reason that Douglas did not mention. Black people had never before been represented on a national monument. In this charged atmosphere of artistic and political firsts, on the eve of the nation's centennial, and amid the deeply disturbing decline and violent overthrow of Reconstruction in the South, Douglas struck notes both majestic and somber. His speech assumed the tone of a requiem, tempered by modest celebration, restrained nationalism, and redemptive hope. African Americans had tenuously arrived, finally and openly, in the center of the country's highest affairs. Douglas made it clear that the unveiling of this monument to Lincoln and emancipation was a national act, performed by citizens in the place where every pulsation of the national heart can be heard, felt, and reciprocated. He insisted on an initial history lesson, referring to the vast and wonderful change in our condition, black freedom and citizenship. No such open commemoration by blacks in Washington would have been tolerated before the Civil War's transformations, without opening floodgates of wrath and violence. Douglass congratulated all, white and black, famous and ordinary, on this contrast between then and now. The orator conditioned his audience for the harder truths and starker metaphors to come by letting them feel the long and dark history of slavery as a matter of the past, replaced now by liberty, progress, and enlightenment. No African-American speaker had ever faced this kind of captive audience, composed of all the leadership of the federal government in one place. And no such speaker would ever again until Barack Obama was inaugurated president in January 2009. Douglass, a master ironist about America, did not miss this moment of supreme symbolism. He named each contingent of every branch of the government sitting before him, including President Grant, Chief Justice Morrison Waite, senators and representatives, cabinet officials, all acknowledged as wise and patriotic. In this moment, the government was something sacred and enduring, newly remade from recent near destruction, the protector of a reconsecrated freedom for whites and blacks. The high officials may have smiled and felt their chests swell at the former slave's patriotic language. Douglass struck chords of civil religion as he described the stately pillars and majestic dome of the Capitol and the district's springtime surroundings as our church. In this new America, all races, colors, and conditions of men composed our congregation. We the colored people, proclaimed Douglass, rejoicing in our blood-bought freedom, now brought the same experience and sentiment like all other Americans who lay in nearby Arlington Cemetery. For the first time in the history of our people, the orator proudly announced, and in the history of the whole American people, we join in this high worship. Then Douglass turned to the memory of Lincoln, and the speech assumed a different tone. While claiming a place for his people in honoring the martyred president, Douglass suddenly used words that may have shocked some in his audience. It must be admitted, truth compels me to admit, even here in the presence of the monument we have erected to his memory, Abraham Lincoln was not either our man or our model. In his interests, in his associations, in his habits of thought, and in his prejudices, he was a white man. Douglass must have caused some squirming in the chairs as he injected race so forthrightly into his rhetorical tribute. Grant might have inwardly flinched. It was as though Douglass had decided to give voice to the kneeling slave on the statue, who would now say thank you as well as speak some bitter truths about a real history, and not merely allow the occasion to be one of proud national self-congratulation. It was as though Douglass was saying, you gave me this unique platform today, and I will therefore teach these lessons about the jagged and tragic paths by which black people achieved freedom in the agony of war. He, Lincoln, was preeminently the white man's president, Douglass continued in his forceful baritone, entirely devoted to the welfare of the white man. He was ready and willing at any time during the first years of his administration to deny, postpone, and sacrifice the rights of humanity in the colored people to promote the welfare of the white people of the country. Douglass employed a stunning level of directness for such a ceremonial occasion. He did not merely turn his moment in the national sun into a reminiscence about a good war and glorious outcomes. Lincoln's growth to greatness and to the role of emancipator, he insisted, must first be seen through the disappointments of his first year in office. Douglass would not consider the triumphal memory of 1865 without first pulling his audience through the pain of 1861. During the secession crisis and into 1862, he remembered, Lincoln had promised to support all constitutional protections of slavery in the southern states. He was willing to pursue, recapture, and send back the fugitive slave to his master, a position Douglass had utterly condemned during the crisis.
The former abolitionist forgot nothing of Lincoln's record on race and slavery, especially the episode in 1862, when in a meeting with five black ministers at the White House, the president strangely told us that we were to leave the land in which we were born, or when he told us he would save the Union with slavery, and refused to retaliate our murder and torture as colored soldiers. The litany of Lincoln's sins against the cause of abolition was long and ugly, especially for this celebratory moment. But Douglas rejected empty politeness. Then came the most striking and lasting words of the speech. The race to which we belong were not the special objects of his, Lincoln's, consideration, Douglas declared to the ages. My white fellow citizens, you are the children of Abraham Lincoln. We are at best only his stepchildren, children by adoption, children by forces of circumstances and necessity. But one of those stepchildren was lecturing the nation and its leaders on that April day. To you, he told whites in the audience, belonged the prime responsibility of honoring Lincoln. Then he implored them to let the stepchildren have their place in the commemoration. Despite not the humble offering we this day unveil, he pleaded, for while Abraham Lincoln saved for you a country, he delivered us from a bondage, according to Jefferson, 1 hour of which was worse than ages of the oppression your fathers rose in rebellion to oppose. Although blacks' faith in Lincoln, who had tarried long in the mountain, had been sorely tested, Douglas found a middle way, a historically balanced remembrance of Lincoln in this new moment of national trial. Through a comprehensive view, in the stern logic of events, and in view of the divinity that shapes our ends, he said, blacks, despite grief and bewilderment at the president's slow actions, concluded that the hour and the man of our redemption had somehow met in the person of Abraham Lincoln. In Douglas's analysis, historical circumstance had in the end made Lincoln the head of a great movement. Most important, Douglas used a refrain that formed the argument of his speech. Under his rule, he repeatedly declared, all manner of great change came about. Slaves were lifted from bondage to self-aware liberty. Black men exchanged rags for Union soldiers' uniforms. 200,000 marched in the cause. The Black Republic of Haiti received recognition. The domestic slave trade was abolished, and a slave trader hanged as a pirate and murderer. And the Confederate States, based upon the idea that our race must be slaves, was battered to pieces and scattered to the four winds. And under his rule, the immortal paper, the Emancipation Proclamation, emerged, making slavery forever impossible in the United States. Douglas had named the pain and betrayal of ages. Now he entered the celebration. He remembered poignantly his own special experience of Emancipation Night, January 1st, 1863, in Boston. He acknowledged that Lincoln had had to work toward emancipation against virulently racist opposition, and therefore had to find the delicate method and timing for such a revolution. He recognized how deeply intertwined Union and emancipation had become, not least because of Lincoln's brilliant political statesmanship. Hence, viewed from the genuine abolition ground, Mr. Lincoln seemed tardy, cold, dull, and indifferent. But measuring him from the sentiment of his country, a sentiment he was bound as a statesman to consult, he was swift, zealous, radical, and determined. As the mature political activist and writer, observer of world historical transformations and betrayals, Douglas had learned much about both the burden and the uses of ambivalence. In the rhetorical twists and turns of this complex speech, Douglas had one overriding target, the declension and betrayal of Reconstruction in the South by the federal government. Under his rule and in due time was Douglass's way of saying not simply that Lincoln had personally saved and reimagined the Union, as well as liberated the slaves, but that the entire nation had done so and carried the burden of responsibility. That black freedom and the fate of the Civil War constitutional amendments, the civic lives and personal survival of the freed people, were on the line in the South at that very moment, and that Grant and the government had to be called to action, formed Douglass's essential subject. But it already seemed too late. By 1876, a pivotal general election year and the nation's centennial celebration, only three Southern states remained unredeemed by the white counter-revolution against Reconstruction. Each of them, Louisiana, South Carolina, and Florida, had Republican-controlled regimes teetering on the brink of political extinction at the hands of terror, murder, and election fraud organized in the service of the Democratic Party and white supremacy. Indeed, the White South's revival and takeover of its political fate and the systematic destruction of black civil and political rights, as well as economic independence, had left a cloud of despair over what remained of any Reconstruction policy by the Grant administration. Worst of all, the experiment in racial democracy born of emancipation and the remaking of the U.S. Constitution, the dream come true in 1865, and the legacy Douglass had for more than 10 years trumpeted as the long-term hope of his people, not only lay in tatters, it had been crushed by widespread, unpunished violence. Many hundreds murdered trying to vote or establish livelihoods, thousands more tortured or intimidated away from voting, and ballot boxes stuffed or stolen. This was the sorrowful state of American democracy in that spring of 1876. Each note of either cautionary woe or modest celebration in Douglass's dedication speech at the monument, with Lincoln standing majestically over the kneeling, subservient former slave, needs to be considered through this story of the impending fateful defeat of Reconstruction. At one and the same time, the speech was Douglass's careful statement of the great growth and change that Lincoln had presided over during the Revolutionary War years, and a lament over the apparent success of the counter-revolution against it. As he concluded, Douglass gave his audience a thoroughly mythic Lincoln, a gift from freed slaves to the nation's best sense of itself, despite all the terror emanating from the South. He brought the Illinoisan into the community of freedmen. The president had been a man of work, a son of toil, the plebeian, honest boatman, whose moral training came from labor. On this anniversary of the assassination, Douglass called that national nightmare for all its redemptive symbolism as well as power in the politics of memory. Lincoln's murder, he declared, was not only the hell-black revenge of Confederate agents, but the crowning crime of slavery itself. As Reconstruction fell to new hell-black actions by ex-Confederates, Douglass spoke to and for the black people who had planned and provided this event. "This was a good work for our race today," he announced, "fastening ourselves to a name, immortal, and defending ourselves against all who would scourge us beyond the range of human brotherhood." Douglass's Freedmen's Memorial Address was the tortured effort of a national stepchild to find the words that might still make the high and mighty of the United States hold the remaining lifeline to its people. It was an extraordinary first thing he dearly hoped would not be a last thing. Douglass knew something of toil and honest boatmen. He was born a slave within yards of the Tuckahoe River on Maryland's eastern shore. He traveled in a sloop out the Wye and Miles rivers and up the Chesapeake Bay to Baltimore as a youth. And he crossed the Susquehanna and the Hudson in his epic escape from slavery. He knew something of rivers. When the shad or herring were running, Betsy Bailey, Douglas's grandmother, a master fisherwoman, would often spend half days waist deep in the beautiful, nearly 100-yard-wide Tuckahoe, tending and pulling her seine nets. One of the greatest stories in American history began in February 1818 at the northwest corner of a horseshoe bend in the Tuckahoe, just above its muddy banks and layers of lush reeds, around a humble cabin managed by Betsy, a slave, and her husband, Isaac Bailey, a free man. Douglas lived most of his life believing that he had been born in 1817, but a handwritten inventory of slaves kept by his owner at birth, Aaron Anthony, recorded Frederick Augustus, son of Harriet, February 1818. He may have been born in the grandparents' cabin, or in slave quarters near the tenant farmer's house, not far away from where his mother likely lived, or even in a field nearby. The land and the extended families of slaves were part of the Home Hill Farm, owned by Anthony, whom Douglas called Old Master. Anthony owned some 30 people and adjoining farms of 600 acres in all. Although he did not live at Home Hill, he was the managing overseer of a much larger operation, the Y Plantation, some 12 miles to the west. By his brutal exercise of power, and possibly by blood, Anthony was, and still is, a crucial and mysterious figure in Douglas's story. The district in which Douglas lived his first 6 years was known as Tuckahoe, in the northeast section of Talbot County, the whole of which was drained by the larger Choptank River as it meandered to Chesapeake Bay. Douglas later uncharitably described the area as famine-stricken, with a worn-out, sandy, desert-like appearance of its soil. But he could also remember with a somber nostalgia the stillness of Tuckahoe and the Kentucky Ravine, as it was locally known, which provided a path down to the river's edge. The nearest villages and the first towns he ever saw were Hillsboro, just 2 miles upriver to the north of the Bailey's cabin, and Denton, due east across the river in Caroline County, some 5 miles away. The boy enjoyed many hours of watching the commercial bustle and the great wheel around Lee's Mill, just a mile north across fields of corn. Frederick Augustus Washington Bailey was the son of Harriet Bailey, one of Betsy and Isaac's 5 enslaved daughters. The second of the multiple names, most uncommon for a slave, can be attributed to his uncle Augustus, Harriet's brother, who had died 2 years before the boy's birth. Washington? Perhaps his mother, lonely and sexually abused, with so little to provide for her newborn, sought in a moment of anguished pride to link this child to the father of the country, rather than to a father he could never really know. Frederick only rarely saw his mother in the first years of his life. His tender and lyrical remembrances of her are almost pure invention. He never saw her at his grandmother's cabin, but recollected a handful of nighttime visits from his mother after he was transferred to the large Y Plantation at age 6. Born in 1792, Harriet gave birth to 7 children between 1813 and 1825. Year after year, she was hired out to other farms, often as much as 12 miles away. But she sometimes walked the distances to visit her children at night, and trekked dusty paths back to meet the overseer's horn by morning. "My poor mother," Douglas wrote, "like many other slave women, had many children, but no family." Douglas's knowledge of his mother, he maintained, was scanty but very distinct. "Her personal appearance and bearing are ineffaceably stamped upon my memory." As time passed in his autobiographical quest, Douglas's mother grew in stature, beauty, and influence. In 1845, he recollected that he had never seen her in daylight. But by 1855, she emerged from memory tall and finely proportioned, of deep black glossy complexion, had regular features, and, among other slaves, was remarkably sedate in her manners.
What the cruelty of slavery had stolen from him, he seized back in his empowering imagination. Douglas found a picture of an Egyptian king, Ramses, in James Cowles Pritchard's Natural History of Man, the features of which so resemble those of my mother that I often recur to it with something of the feeling which I suppose others experience when looking upon the pictures of dear departed ones. The mother he hardly knew became dignified, even regal, all but without gender, and one of many shields of protection he built around himself as a storyteller. In a scene that became common in male slave narratives, Douglas told of the last time he saw his mother. In 1825, perhaps February, not long after he had been taken to live with Anthony's family at the Y House and under the stern, abusive rule of the cook, Aunt Katie, Douglas remembered a wonderful visit from Harriet Bailey, at least while it lasted. Frederick had greatly annoyed Aunt Katie one day, and she promised as punishment to starve the life out of me. When all the other children hanging around the kitchen received their warm cornbread, Katie purposely denied young Fred even a morsel. As he sat in a dark corner of the kitchen as the night wore on, hungry, and stealing some Indian corn from a shelf, suddenly his mother appeared to save him. Harriet gave her boy a sweet ginger cake and read Aunt Katie a lecture she never forgot. The cake was in the shape of a heart with a rich, dark ring glazed upon the edge of it, implying that it may have been Valentine's Day around the Anthony farms. Douglas called this a pivotal scene in his early life, and converted it into both stinging anti-slavery propaganda and an unforgettable expression of the personal pain and loss at the heart of his childhood. That night, I learned the fact, he remembered, that I was not only a child, but somebody's child. I was victorious, for the moment, prouder on my mother's knee than a king upon his throne. But the moment was brief. He dropped off to blissful sleep. In the morning, his mother had gone back to her field hands duty miles away. It was the last time he saw Harriet Bailey. She died sometime the next year, in 1826, her illness and her grave unknown. Douglas implies that he was told of his mother's illness as she deteriorated out at the Home Hill farm, but was not allowed to visit her. As a world-famous abolitionist in 1855, Douglas knew well how this story would play on the emotions of his readers. But his words must also be read and interpreted as a child's screams transported by memory into the anguished heart of a lifelong orphan. The heartless and ghastly form of slavery rises between mother and child, even at the bed of death, he offered to his sentimental readers. Then he simply spoke for himself and millions of other former slaves, dead and living. It has been a lifelong standing grief to me that I knew so little of my mother, and that I was so early separated from her. The counsels of her love must have been beneficial to me. The side view of her face is imaged on my memory, and I take few steps in life without feeling her presence. But the image is mute, and I have no striking words of hers treasured up. Douglas could see her only from a blurry side view, her voice muted, her very presence glimpsed from a picture of Egyptian majesty and physiognomy in a natural history book. But he was not left silent. With great enthusiasm, he said, he later learned that his mother could read, and that she was the only one of all the slaves and colored people in Tuckahoe who could do so. Her achievement was very extraordinary, he proudly declared, and for his own love of letters, he credited the native genius of my sable, unprotected, and uncultivated mother, who belonged to a race whose mental endowments it is fashionable to hold in disparagement and contempt. For such a great orator and writer to make this claim says at the very least a good deal about how dearly he yearned to know
and understand his genealogical and temporal roots in the people and soil of Maryland's eastern shore. It also may say that, even to Douglas himself, his extraordinary talent with language, his voice, remained something of a beautiful mystery. The identity of his father was an equal but hardly beautiful mystery.